I think we go straight on with the proceedings, and I introduce to you Dr. Alan Rayner, who's going to talk to you about new avenues for understanding the processes of tree decay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Caroline, and thank you also for the interest which you've shown here. I must say I'm completely amazed by the size of the audience, totally overwhelmed by it, really, and I only hope I can do you all justice. There's no doubt that fungi cause decay in the wood of trees. However, the bewildering range of circumstances under which such decay occurs make it not so easy for us to be certain about the variety of dynamic processes that enable fungi to bring decay about, or indeed how we should really view the consequences of decay in relation to tree health. For example, it may be that it is only the central part of the main trunk that is affected by decay, giving rise to voluminous columns of heartrot, with correspondingly large fungal fruit bodies on the outside. If I can have the first slide, please. So here is what many of you might regard as an ominous sight, an enormous mass of fruit bodies of Gryphula frondosa at the base of a veneer oak tree in the Forest of Dean. And once that tree was felled, of course, oops, I've gone the wrong way as usual. Let's see if we can do it the right way. We see that the central core of the heartwood is extensively decayed and the value of the timber is completely lost. Or it may only be the sapwood that is decayed, sometimes within the vicinity of obvious wounds, such as those that may be caused by pruning, stem damage, extraction damage, or localized patches of dead bark. Of course, one of the problems about forestry and removing timber from the forest is that extensive damage is often caused by the trees that are left behind, as we see here. And here's an example of me on holiday in the Gower, next door to a larger sycamore tree, which has been extensively damaged and is covered in fruit bodies of Serena unicolor, just that we see here, which is a fungus which is able to colonize wounded trees. Here's an example of a piece of wood, which is actually cut from a living branch, which has been deliberately inoculated here with a decay fungus, and we can see the fungus colonizing directly from the site of inoculation down into the sapwood. Here are some parts of sycamore trees which have been damaged by a disease affecting the bark. Here we've got very extensive damage so that only a thin layer of bark has been left. And you can see that the whole cylinder of wood in this case has been exposed to fungal colonization, consequent discoloration and staining. Sometimes, though, there may not be very obvious wounds from which colonization has occurred, and decay may underlie extensive sections or strips of dead bark in what may otherwise seem to be apparently intact branches and trunks of varying diameter. Some of the fungi that are responsible for decay that we see in these sorts of situations often show a high degree of selectivity or preference for trees of a particular type. For example, here we see Piptoporus betulinus, the birch polypore, colonizing birch tree, and that fungus is never found on any other tree than birch. Another rather selective fungus, at least in terms of where we find its fruit bodies, is Daldinia concentrica, which I'm sure many of you will recognize, these lovely sort of black charcoal lumps, or King Alfred's cakes, as they're often referred to, for obvious reasons, and with these concentric zones of tissue inside, which gives the scientific name Daldinia concentrica. Lynn and I, many years ago, got interested in the fungi that colonize attached living oak branches. And we slowly began to realize not only was there a rather characteristic and special group of fungi that colonize actually attached partially living branches of oak while still in the canopy. But the patterns of decay that these fungi cause are very different from those which are associated with wounds. And this was one of the reasons that we started to come to question some of the traditional attitudes and ideas about how decay becomes established in trees. We would find that certain fungi colonizing attached oak branches would be found in branches of a particular diameter or branch order. Here is Peniophora quercina. These are little fruit bodies of the fungus on a small outer branch of oak. Here is Vulaminia comedens, which characteristically forms this smooth crust, and the bark characteristically peels away to reveal this fruit body. And here, believe it or not, the whole of this length of this branch is colonized by a fungus called Sterium gorsopatum. When we cut that branch down, here's the decay caused by the fungus. Here's the living sapwood adjacent to that decay. And here is a region of what looks like a sort of reaction between the decayed wood and the undecayed wood. Because this region is continuous with the heartwood, we decided to call this sort of formation a heartwood wing. And you'll see why a little bit more clearly in a few moments. The other thing that you might be interested to note here is that there is no additional annual ring in the sapwood here, in the living sapwood, next to this junction point there, and that the entire of this decay column was actually, which was something like 4 or 5 metres long in this particular case, thereby would seem to have formed within a single growing season. We were absolutely shattered at the thought that a fungus should establish such an enormously long decay column in such a short time, and it began to make us think very differently about how decay processes might be initiated. And I'm sure this is something that Lynn will be talking to you in more detail about a little bit later on. But meanwhile, let's move on a little bit. This sort of observation starts to make sense of something which I'm sure all of you have noticed. Whenever you look at a lovely mature oak tree like this, there are always lots of branches that are dead and which have been there for a long time. Here's an example. And I'm sure most of you noticed the beautiful sculpturing which is often present on these branches. They have this ridged and grooved look. Yeah? But when you think about it, well, why is that? It actually means that the sapwood has been colonized and decayed away. We're left with the heartwood. But why the ridged and grooved appearance? Well, of course, the ridges are actually, I've already shown you, are heartwood wings, which are formed at the interfaces between colonized and uncolonized wood. And as the colonized wood decays away under the action of fungi and also under the action of insects, which like eating wood colonized by fungi, then we sort of expose this skeleton underneath, which reminds us of an ancient battle that has been going on within the branch between the invading fungi and the living branch itself. This is actually part of a branch which has been cut down from the canopy, showing these ridges. And I'm going to show you this end here, which is partially living. Here's the living wood. Here's the decayed wood. And here you can actually see the ridges are beginning to be exposed as a result of the decayed wood being removed as a result of animal activity. So it's sort of like putting a mammal carcass to rot it slowly, this skeleton reveals itself. And here's the other end, again, with these lovely ridges, which are these heartwood wings. Another aspect of this, which is difficult to see quite in the lighting conditions here, but this is a beech tree with what's known as a strip canker. You might just be able to detect, going right along, right up the tree to about that point there, is a black strip. All that strip is occupied probably by one or a very few genetic individuals of a particular species of fungus known as Eutypa spinosa. And again, we have this phenomenon of an apparently extraordinarily extensive fungal individual being produced within a very short time, in this case, very much associated with drought conditions. Some sorts of decay are actually associated with particular types of management practice. Here's a coppice stool with lots and lots of branches and poles coming up from it. When you think about that, these poles coming up from a coppice stool must be in considerable competition with one another. And a very characteristic feature of coppicing is that over time, many of the individual poles die and become colonized by fungi, and by very special fungi as well, seem to make a particular living in coppiced trees. There are two coppiced poles of hazel here. This one is covered by fruit bodies of Sterium rugosum, and there's probably a single mycelium of that fungus all the way through that pole, a single genetic individual. Over here, you can't really tell, but there are little bumps, which are the perithecial stromata of Hypoxylon fuscum, and there are probably several thousand individuals of Hypoxylon fuscum in that branch. Then, of course, there are patterns of decay, especially heart rot, which are associated with pollarding. And here, an ancient pollard with a totally hollow centre, photographed to give this rather dramatic effect. Or that was my story. It was really late in the day, and I hadn't been thinking very carefully about how I used the camera. Rather artistic. And in plantation forestry, thinning and clear felling practices may actually aid the spread of root colonizing fungi. Here we see a clear felled site, and that sort of operation may often encourage such fungi as Heterobasidian anosum, whose fruit bodies we see here, and Armillaria species, honey fungus, whose fruit bodies we see there. In the case of Heterobasidian anosum, the thinning and felling practices, of course, expose wounds and cut stump surfaces, which can be colonized by spores of the fungus, which are able to grow into the stumps, down into the roots, and then transfer from infected roots onto living roots, and then hence spread disease through a forest stand. Here, of course, the rhizomorphs of honey fungus is characteristic mycelial form of that fungus, and how this fungus, when it arrives at a root by means of rhizomorphs, switches a form into this sort of white felty mycelial fans, which colonize immediately under the bark. And another such thing there. So we've got an immense array of different sorts of circumstances in which decay may develop. And only in extreme cases is the relationship between the fungal colonists and the tree tissues clear-cut. One of these extremes is when a fungus actively kills functional tissues as its primary means of colonization. An example is indeed honey fungus. Alternatively, things may be relatively clear when the fungus colonizes fully dead tissue, which has been killed by something other than the fungus itself. So we can look at those two sorts of extremes. Many people would talk about parasites and saprophytes. But these represent the absolute extremes in a whole spectrum of sorts of activities, a wide spectrum of relationships that may form between fungi and trees, and that may be both complex and finely balanced, such that small changes in environmental circumstances may actually lead to fundamental shifts in outcome. So, of course, many of you are familiar, married people, of course, and you can think about this, how very small events can suddenly blow up out of all proportion. And, of course, all relationships are like that. Fungi and tree relationships are no different. So in these cases, if I can have the first overhead, please, the projector off for a moment, a variety of riddles of cause and consequence beset us, introducing, if you like, an uncertainty principle into our understanding of fungus-trees relationships that renders the application of fully predictive, rigid definitions of fungal roles not only logistically impossible, but liable, perhaps, to lead to inappropriate management. We may be concerned with, is the fungus a pathogen? Is it really a decay agent? Now I know why I should have worn my glasses here. Part of that question needs us to answer this one. Is the tree or part of the tree dying or dysfunctional because it is colonized? Or is it colonized because it's dying and dysfunctional? That is a real problem to disentangle that question. Even if we decide it's colonized because it's dying or dysfunctional, we then may ask, well, why is it dying or dysfunctional? Is it because of an external environmental factor abetted by or helping the fungus? Or is it an internal process, if you can move that slightly over? Intrinsic process, such as aging. Whatever the mechanism of death and ultimately decay, we must ask, really, the question is, how is the evolutionary fitness of the tree affected? And if the answer is, well, it's either not affected, or in fact the tree is helped by decay, then we have to ask, well, what is a healthy tree, and what the hell is a pathogen, as far as the fungus is concerned? Now, in contemplating such questions, it really is all too easy not to recognize their chicken and egg-like nature, but rather to take sides and view the issues only from a narrow and human standpoint. Processes or factors that result in the exclusion of decay fungi from woody tissues may then be regarded as necessarily defensive and there for that purpose. Necessarily defensive and there for that purpose. Correspondingly, processes that result in the ingress of fungi into woody tissues are interpreted as necessarily aggressive. We identify absolute goody and absolute baddie and observe what we perceive as their mortal combat with impassioned prejudice. This is certainly an appealing, if unsubtle, approach. Easy to communicate in the short term, but perhaps not enhancing the real understanding that in the longer term helps us to contain, prevent, or learn to live with decay processes. I've been trying to take a more dispassionate line in my own thinking, as though viewing, shall we say, an Olympic event in which there are no British competitors. I'm all right at the moment. Yep. I've asked myself how the ways in which trees and fungi organize themselves as dynamic systems affects the balance between them when they meet. So if I can have the next overhead, please, now. So this is the basic question, the basic issue which one can try to address. How do the ways in which fungi and trees organize themselves as dynamic systems affect the balance between them when they meet? I've come to think that the nature of this dynamic balance and how it may be shifted is critical to understanding variations in the longevity of individual trees or parts of trees, and how indeed that longevity may be affected by environmental change. One of the most important considerations when you're thinking about imminent environmental change is to realize that most of the systems we observe in nature are systems in balance. Trees and fungi are systems in balance, and a minute change in conditions has the potential to drastically alter the nature of that balance. And this is, I think, something that we ought to be much more aware of in thinking about the greenhouse effect. For example, people think directly about how changed climate is going to affect the tree. They don't ask the question, how is it going to affect the balance between the tree and its fungi and its fungal community? And that may be far more significant than the direct effect. If I can have the next overhead, then. Well, let's think about fungi and trees as dynamic systems. And you see that I'm going to think about them really, or consider them as indeterminate collectives. What that means will become clear, I hope, in a few moments' time. Now, part of the reason for the complexity and unpredictability of fungus-tree relationships is, of course, that trees and fungi are themselves complex and variable beings. Trees and fungi are complex and variable beings. I think that there's been a very persistent tendency to think of the tree as complex and the fungus as simple. And that is a message that I want to destroy for you this morning. Fungi are complex. Many people are well aware of the distinctive patterns of decay that are produced by different species of fungi in different species of tree. Moreover, both fungi and trees produce genetically variable populations. Looking at a fungal population and the variation within it, I'm gazing across this room and I could be gazing across a fungal population, if you don't mind. There has been some recent scientific evidence that fungi and people are very closely related, so you'll excuse this analogy. Since we've got genetically variable populations, different genetic combinations of the same fungal and tree species will be prone automatically to interact distinctively. But the point which I think I most want to emphasize now is the variability and uncertainty which is implicit in the development of individual trees and fungi. Thinking about ourselves, our own development and that of many other animals is remarkably foreclosed or determinate. From conception, we follow a strict, genetically determined developmental program, culminating in a more or less fixed adult form that degenerates to eventual certain death. Any internally or externally induced departure from our normal developmental sequence is liable to be catastrophic. So we react rather differently from a tree to having our limbs and organs pruned. In trees, and to an even greater extent fungi, development is much more open-ended and much more responsive to circumstance. That it is, development is indeterminate. Here, distinctive functional modes can be produced as and when needed, providing a kind of versatility that is denied to individual animals, but is akin to that which can occur in certain social collectives, such as armies. To put it another way, indeterminate development we can think of as being fluid dynamical, involving some form of collective organization within a deformable boundary that results in a productive interplay between expansive and constraining processes. If you counteract something which is trying to expand with something which is trying to constrain, you can perhaps imagine the huge variety of developmental patterns which you are capable of producing. And indeed, when we think in this sort of way, it becomes apparent that dissociative or expansive private enterprise processes and associative, constraining, socialistic processes are not alternatives in a dynamic system, but interdependent. To put it another way, or another way of thinking, which I might quote here, is to quote from Sun Tzu in 500 BC. Which rather nicely illustrates the nature of a sort of fluid dynamical processes as they might operate within an army. Military tactics are like unto water. For water in its natural course runs away from high places and hastens downwards. So in war, the way to avoid what is strong is to strike what is weak. Water shapes its own course according to the ground over which it flows. The soldier works out his victory in relation to the foe he is facing. And so it is with trees and fungi. Both are in fact, or in effect, plumbing or irrigational systems in which water and associated materials are channeled or distributed through interconnected, branching series of pipes and valves from sites of active uptake from the environment to sites of discharge or deformation of the system's boundary. If I could have the next overhead, please. So we can actually start, and one of the messages, we need to think about trees as plumbing systems. We need equally to think about fungi as plumbing systems. And in both cases, we need to think about how thrust, hydraulic thrust, is developed within the system. That is, directional pressure is developed and maintained within the system. Well, thrust can be maintained, of course, by preventing loss of pressure along the lateral boundaries of conduits and at sites of damage. Any plumber will tell you that water-resistant materials are very important in his graft. And by means of water-resistant, or, if you like, insulating compounds, we can manage the development and maintenance of thrust within one of these systems. The actual disposition of these compounds is critical to the patterns produced by the system and appears likely to be controlled by an extraordinarily elegant feedback process or feedback response mechanism. If you think, what would I do if I could only automatically manage things to do the right thing at the right time? So if insulation can be automatically reduced at sites of active uptake and discharge from the system, and automatically increased at sites of conservation and redistribution, you produced an extraordinarily energetically efficient system. And that's actually what the plumber, in many ways, attempts to do. Some of the compounds that are involved in insulation have a phenolic or terpenoid origin, and their production and interaction with phenol oxidizing enzymes can generate free radicals, which are highly reactive molecules with unpaired electrons. And the presence of these free radicals, if they're developed inside the system, can lead to cell death. If, of course, they're produced outside, then they affect chemical cross-linking, which can affect the insulation of the system. Cell death, death. Well, actually, it's important to recognize that in this context, in an indeterminate system, death is not disastrous, but an inevitable adjunct of the indeterminate way of life, providing ways of sealing off boundaries and redistributing resources. To us determinate systems, we think of death as being a bad thing because death tends to be a bit absolute. In an indeterminate system, death only occurs in part of the system and actually can contribute to the functioning of the system, both in sealing off its boundaries and redistributing its resources. So these are some of the generalities of the plumbing systems of trees and fungi. And I want Lau to look a little bit more specifically at the way these systems operate. First of all, let's look at fungi as dynamic plumbing systems. Have you ever thought of dynamic plumbing? Now think about fungi. Well, the first thing, if we have that off and start the slides again. The important thing that we have to think about with fungi, of course, is that most of us are familiar with the fruit bodies of fungi, the reproductive structures by which they disseminate their spores. But the real working part of the fungus, the part that gains energy from the environment and distributes that energy into fungal form and ultimately produces the fruit bodies, is the mycelium. And if we're to understand fungi, there's nothing for it. We have to understand the mycelium and all the properties that relate to the mycelial form. The next few slides will perhaps illustrate some aspects of what mycelial organization is all about. Fungal mycelia can often be conveniently grown on plates full of nutrient jelly, as we see here. And this is a mycelium which is, we cut a bit of the medium out, put it onto the centre of this jelly, and outgrew this colony, which is the mycelium of a fungus. We look at that a little bit closer, and we start to see the fibrous structure of that cottony growth. We look a bit closer still, and we start to make out individual fibres or filaments. If we look a little bit closer still, inside the tubes, we see that these are indeed tubes surrounded by a cell wall filled with protoplasm, which is the cellular material in organisms. Here's a nucleus, here's a mitochondria, here's a thing called the Spitzenkörper. And we look a little bit closer still, and we can see the organization of that protoplasm inside the hyphal tubes as revealed by electron microscopy. And we can put all that together into this wonderful image of the complex architecture of cellular material inside the tubes of these branching networked systems, which we call mycelia. Well, the prevailing popular view of this feeding part of most fungi, the mycelium, is that it is an unsophisticated, greedy, homogeneous mass that grows in direct proportion to the amount that it consumes. This is an attitude that probably reflects the way that most scientists who study fungi or culture fungi do so under conditions in the laboratory that can only be described as ones of severe sensory and sexual deprivation. As far as fungal growth in trees is concerned, the mycelium is regarded as being either present or absent, growing or not growing. And all attention then switches to what the tree does or doesn't do about it. That is an idea I wish to destroy. The reality is very different. The mycelium is a sophisticated, open-ended, fluid dynamical system that negotiates the twists and turns of its heterogeneous environmental settings with extraordinary flexibility and versatility. It does not develop in any fully set sequence, but rather can interconvert between a variety of functional modes, probably partly controlled genetically, and partly by what we can call local government feedback with the environment. I can have the next overhead, please. Projector off just for a second. It all begins over here, somewhere, when a fungal spore arises at a suitable state, place, and germinates. Characteristically, the early stages are ones of expansion, even expansion in all directions. I want to write a book about why the universe is a mycelium sometime, and perhaps this will tell you. But what we have is we have an initial isotropic expansion from the spore. This can then be followed by actually producing more spores or giant cells. But the most crucial thing as far as the mycelium is concerned, there is a critical point at which that initially homogeneously expanding system breaks symmetry, starts to become asymmetrical, develop polarity, that is, distribute pressure in a particular direction, i.e. develop thrust. That is the emergence of a germ tube. The emerging hypha then starts to assimilate nutrients from its surroundings. As it does so, the system starts to branch. The branches then may tend to be divergent. We get this open-ended growth, and we have a radial component to growth, which we can think of as being explorative, and a sort of tangential component, which consolidates. Over time, a very important thing then starts to happen as we generate this branching radiate system in higher fungi. Some of the branches actually start to anastomose, cross-link, and transform this system into a network with open-ended margins. Now, anyone who's studied maps must be familiar with the sorts of process that I've just been describing as to how we develop first a radiate communication followed by a network. And fungi actually illustrate this idea beautifully. Okay, if we can have that off and the projector back on. This actually illustrates the fact that you don't necessarily following germination immediately go to mycelium. You can actually, many fungi can exist both as yeasts, as a cellular form, and as a mycelial form. As the colony develops, another very interesting thing that we often find is that the pattern of branching can be varied quite dramatically. This is just a young colony of a fungus called Coniophora puteana. And the initial pattern of branching has produced a dense mass of branches, and then suddenly, one part of the system's boundary, we've got hyphae which are branching much less frequently and at acute angles. It's as though they're distributing thrust in a particular direction now, and the fungus is rushing out in a much more explorative mode, having gone through a first phase of establishment. We can see this sort of phenomenon in culture on a petri dish of slow dense colonies, fast diffuse colonies, and switches from one to the other. It's alike to changing gear in a motor car. Do you ever think that fungi can change gear? It's the same dynamic principle which is involved of changing the relative ratios to give variable thrusts forward movement. Inside those hyphal tubes may be partitions that act as valves. These are septa, and the septa are often very complex. This is the dolipore septum of a basidiomycete fungus. This actually, and within one and the same mycelium, may have different developmental phases, some of which are partitioned by valves in this way, some of which are not. This is an early stage of development of a colony of Phanerichaetae magnolii. At this stage, the fungus is non-septate. There are no internal partitions inside these tubes. There's very little branching. In fact, this whole structure is a single cell, a cenocyte, and that scale bar is 1 millimeter. So it's branching very, very sparsely in that case. Later on, it started to develop septa. It started to develop lateral branches. The lateral branches fused into a network and, well, so forth. Here's actually a picture of a colony of Phlebia radiata, which characteristically grows by means of an exploring front of hyphae, which are non-septate, which are followed up by a set of hyphae which are septate and much more branched. And these two distinctive phases in the mycelium have totally different physiological and ecological characteristics. Indeterminacy allows you to keep changing mode and literally to have your cake and to eat it. The process of anastomosis, fusion, which produces these networks, is terribly important in our understanding of mycelial systems. Here's this process illustrated. This hypha here has grown towards this one here. It's just point of contact is there. Here we're actually beginning to see that hypha flattening onto that point of contact. Here we've actually established continuity between the two so that it's formed a junction and protoplasm may flow across the junction. And in this particular case, the fungus has then isolated the junction off again with one of these septa. The hyphae may either grow in a diffuse form, or they may associate together into cable-like structures. So it's a bit like, well, you know, the mycelium could sort of think about telephone networks. You can develop your local network, and then once you've got that, you can put cables together and develop international telephone links. And fungi can do just that. Here's a fungus which has been grown through a tube of sterile soil where the mycelium has stayed diffuse and it's not progressing very fast. And this one, the hyphae have aggregated together into cable-like structures to produce these wonderful mycelial cords. Here's a fungus that's associated with the fact that fungal mycelia don't just absorb energy from their environment, they distribute it. So they have both assimilative, absorbing modes, and distributive phases. If they didn't, they wouldn't work.